iVow. I'm Jenny Prisk, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the first in our series of Women Peacemakers Conversations and to introduce our guest, Dr. Rubina Feroz Bhatti of Pakistan. I first met Rubina in 2009 when she was in residence as a woman peacemaker at the University of San Diego Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice. Rubina was born into a Christian family in the majority Muslim country of Pakistan. She is a well-known, respected global human rights activist who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. Rubina, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You are a human rights activist who fights for equal rights for minorities and women in Pakistan. What was the catalyst for this work?
You know, to become an activist, and particularly human rights activist, it's not an easy job, and it would not appear overnight. So the key thing is, when you are living in an environment, and particularly when you are living in a very challenging environment, so you conceive and you absorb the situation and the issues and what are the developments with that environment and the way then how you respond to that environment. So this is the key thing when you become an activist. And I born in a country with majority Muslim population. So being a minority, the environment and the context was very challenging for me. And even as a child, I realized many times that I am someone different as compared to other children, I mean the Muslims' children. But I was not very aware of what exactly this means and how could I respond to that. So maybe the concept of or the feeling of fear, inferiority was more dominant rather than my strong reaction or activism. But within the passage of time, when I went to school and I joined some school activities and student unions, I learned what is the power to be a part of a group. And of course, my main instinct was my feminist part of my life. And then I realized that being a woman or being a girl, I should respond if there is some injustice, if there is some inequality. And that was the thing which made me an activist.
So you started your activism at a very early age.
Yeah, I did.
Were you different from the other girls that you had in your groups or at school? Were you different?
You know, Jenny, actually the thing is, when you are a minority, and when you are from a minority group, there are two things. Either you will be subjugated or you will react positively or more strongly, and you will get empowered day by day. Mm-hmm. Because you learn that there is no one to help you. You have to help you on your own. And maybe that was the point when I realized, even in my school life, when people and when my fellow student, even sometimes my teachers, they discriminated me as a Christian student. And then I learned what are the bridging points, who will be the connector, and how can I integrate with this large fabrics of society. And the point was I joined different co-curriculum activities. I tried to become a very smart student in a way to get good grades so I would be accepted by the majority. This was the key spirit or the key purpose behind all this struggle, was that I have to be accepted by them. Mm-hmm. And the passage of time, particularly in college life, then I worked closely with Catholic Church and I got more strength, because first you have to calculate your binding capital. You have to create your allies within your community. And that was done at the platform of Catholic Church. And after that, I tried to cultivate my bridging capital. And with that strength and skills and knowledge, I integrated with the majority. And when I was working with Catholic Church, some of the times during my activism time, I was the only woman in many meetings and protests. But I never realized that I am a woman. at that point, my only feeling was, oh, I have to respond to all these injustices in a more positive way to create a more peaceful, more prosperous and more, harmonized society in Pakistan.
How were you treated as the only woman among some of these gatherings and meetings that you attended?
When you are working with a group, there are your opponents, there are also your friends, your allies within the group and also outside the group. Because if you are working with a group, of course, they give you a space and then you can work with them. But the point is, do they ready to give you a leadership role? Any woman, when you try to get a leadership role, challenges are more. And this happened with me. But somehow I was a trendsetter, and within the church, I am thankful to clergy and I'm really grateful to them that they give me a space. And for them, I was a kind of human resource who would be able to organize more women and definitely more families. But outside the group, people were criticizing, particularly when you are a woman and very young woman. For them, it's not, you are not bearing a good moral character if you are working with men in my society, mm-hmm. because the good woman means confined themselves within four walls of the house. Mm-hmm. And if you are confined within the four walls, you cannot contribute to the society. You cannot get a space within social networks, within political networks. It means you are nowhere. And of course, I faced many challenges, from character assassination to threats, and I survived.
And we're very glad that you did survive and have continued to survive. So it would seem to me that there were role models in your life. Tell us about them, because I'm thinking also in the direction of your father. I know that women can be oppressed, and yet I sense that perhaps your father helped you with some of your freedom and your ability to become an activist.
You know, I am very fortunate that my father and my mother, both my parents, they were extraordinary. You know, my father was a fascinating storyteller. We are three sisters, and in our childhood, my father was used to tell us stories, very fascinating stories about empowered women. And he cultivated our imagination power through stories. And every story was ended with a sentence, "One day my daughters will be like these women." The story he told us. And those women are always very different women, very empowered women. So, "One day my daughters will be like these empowered women." And this was the point. Of course, all of us, you know, somehow contributed. We played a very key role within our community particularly. And for my mother, she placed a very high value on our education. And she always taught me, whenever I came back from school with very depressing feelings that my fellow student teased me because I am a Christian. Christians mean unclean people. And, they use typical words for us, like we are kind of untouchable. So my mom always said, "Don't worry, you put your entire attention on your education. When you will get good grades, everyone will be your friend." And maybe this was the very, you can say, a kind of soothing feeling, like, okay, if I'll get a good grades, I will be accepted and everyone will be my friend, you know, in my class. And you see, throughout my career, my academic career, I always got good grades, because the point was not I have to get plus, A plus, or, you know, the point was I have to be accepted.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that did work? Did that help? I mean, did your education open doors?
It makes a difference. It makes a difference because you are changing. I was the first Christian woman in my entire district and then division who was appointed as a lecturer in chemistry. I mean, after finishing my master's in chemistry. So it was a totally different feeling. Oh, Christian woman can go up to this level. And now, of course, after finishing my PhD, Again, it's a different feeling. Christian women can do this. So you are not representing yourself or your family. You are representing your entire community.
Yes.
And my mom was my role model because she was an educated woman and she was a teacher. And living in such a patriarchal culture, she always put my brother and, you know, and sisters at the same level. She provided us equal opportunities for education and all of us, you know, got good education. And she encouraged me, like, you have to survive on your own. Being a minority, you have not to look or that someone else will come to help you. And she educated us in a way that people belonging to minority groups, they need to struggle more than rest of the people from majority because mm-hmm. they have more challenges. And she always said, you can do. And this word, you can do, was a kind of as inspiration for me. Yes, I can do. And it keeps me going.
And I know it keeps you going in a number of, yeah. of very, very effective areas. Do you feel now in Pakistan, because of your educational qualifications, that you are being accepted and that people are listening to you and taking note of what you say?
Yes. Of course, after getting education, I have been treated differently. Now my work is recognized. I am very well respected, but still there are discriminations. And the nature of discriminations is totally changed. Now maybe I am less discriminated as a minority, but I am more discriminated as a woman.
And that leads me to my next question, which
yeah.
is,
yeah.
how is non-discrimination progressing for women generally in Pakistan?
There is a lot of work done by the government, and there is a lot of work still government needs to do. For instance, government has recently approved a law, passed a bill, a women's protection bill, which is basically a protection against the domestic violence.
Excellent.
And on the other hand, government has been introducing very, you can say, revolutionary programs. For instance, there is a program, Women on Wheel. And they are providing trainings to women, driving trainings, and then providing them scooties
mm-hmm.
so they can go to their work independently. Mm-hmm. And this will enhance the mobility of women. So
yes.
This is very symbolic. And then they have introduced some of the policies like livelihood programs for women, where they are providing them livestock and other things. So they can earn a decent livelihood. But still, the challenges are within the society. When there is a very strong patriarchal society, you have challenges at two levels, technical mm-hmm. challenges and adaptive challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, technical challenges are much more handled by the government. They are introducing laws, they are introducing programs, pro-women laws, pro-women policies, pro-women programs. But for the adaptive challenges, the major role is for the communities, for the societies.
Mm-hmm.
And the adaptive challenge is to change the attitude, to change the behaviors. So if a woman is going on a scooty for their work, if they are going, how would society respond? Will they respect those women?
Mm-hmm.
Or will they say, okay, they are going against our cultural norms and values.
Mm-hmm.
So the main thing is we have to work with the communities, with the society as well to meet all these adaptive challenges.
This takes a lot of people to spread these actions right through a community.
Mm.
Are you the mobilizer of these groups of people to get this work done? And if so, how do you do that? And is it women that can join you to help with that mobilization?
You know, Jenny, I have been working since last more than two decades, you know, mm-hmm. for minority rights and for women rights. And what I have learned from my experience that we need maybe more kind of integrated approach and public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So we have to strengthen government and government has to strengthen civil society.
Mm-hmm.
Like if government is introducing program, society has to own that program.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to mobilize people. There is a long range of my work. Like I work with the vulnerable people.
Yes.
I mean violence survivor, to provide them kind of different services. We need advocacy work. We need awareness raising. We need women support program. So then we can reach, we can achieve the goal. Programs will only be successful if society will own those programs. That's why what we are struggling hard, we are trying to induct civil society representative in government structures, particularly at local level, at district level, so grassroots women leadership could emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Are people who are excluded, I mean communities like minorities, communities, peasants, work, laborers, are transgender, are these kind of more excluded group. If they would be in those structures, they could get information.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be well aware of what their government is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can translate those information into their communities, and they can get benefit of those program. Otherwise, the program will, you know, move around a certain circle of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would not be a change. So the point is, like, to bring the fruitful results, we need to create more strong public-private partnership.
And how do you go about that in the society that has got these dichotomies of integration? And is the government willing to step forward and fund the programs?
You know, there are some grants which government giving to the people, and sometimes NGOs can get from them. Like there is a big program, poverty alleviation program, and so many NGOs are taking benefit of that program, and they are introducing
mm-hmm.
a livelihood programs for people. But for me, the main point is like where the policies are formulated.
Mm-hmm.
So bring the civil society representative into those structures,
mm-hmm.
and people learn how to introduce those programs, mm-hmm. how to formulate those programs, and how their voices would be included with the what government is going to plan
mm-hmm.
for them. And to mobilize those people, of course, if you will go to the vulnerable groups or excluded groups, they don't have skill or fund to voice for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you need someone else.
You need an advocate for them, advocate. For the
and,
voice.
Yeah. And of course, we are focusing more on media, on religious leaders, and somehow the political political workers within the political parties, so they could create a space within their political parties, you know, within their own structures, and then gradually empower those people to take them up to the government structures. You cannot directly bring a violent survivor into that structure because she would not be able to talk. That environment will be totally different for her. And she will get more depressed maybe.
Yes, because the language won't match and the understanding.
And information and skills, everything is new. So you have to empower those people within the community, within the civil society, and then educate and train them. And after that phase, you can integrate them to the public sector.
Mm-hmm. Because you're fortunate to have the education, and because you've pursued it so ardently yourself, and you're going to receive a PhD from the University of San Diego, which we congratulate you for.
Thank you so much.
You travel the world a lot speaking of these issues and have received numerous awards for all the work that you've done, including, I might say, an N Peace Award from the former Prime Minister of my country, New Zealand, Mrs.
Yeah.
Helen Clark.
Yeah.
Do you feel that Pakistan is truly represented in the global areas that you visit? Do we understand the struggles in Pakistan the way we should? How is the media interpreting?
There are all shades of life in Pakistan, successful women, vulnerable women. But unfortunately, the global media knows more about victim narrative,
yes,
and less about the alternative narrative.
Mm-hmm.
There are very strong women, but they will give example of Benazir Bhutto, and that's it. Women are playing a very key role. Of course, the story of women is the story of struggle. And particularly after Cold War era, when discriminatory laws against women were introduced by General Zia-ul-Haq, the women stood up and they struggled and they spoke against those laws. And it was amazing. You can imagine almost 22-23 decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not that women in Pakistan are all vulnerable. Our minorities are all vulnerable. You know, of course, discriminatory laws against women and against religious minorities still exist in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard thing and it's a kind of dark side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also a bright side. How people spoke and how people have been speaking against these laws, these discriminations, not only within the constitution or the structural violence, but also the direct violence and the cultural violence. And we need to bring those role models and those heroes. They should be documented, and they are the real face of Pakistan and the real image of Pakistan, which unfortunately we hardly see in the global media.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is unfortunate that way.
Yeah.
Because you're right, we get the downside of stories and we don't get the stories of hope.
Yeah.
And progress sufficiently. Speaking of hope and progress, you were the founder of the Tang O Saib organization. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, because you've done some amazing peace work through that.
You know, when I was a lecturer in chemistry, and I was very much interacted with the students, and we noticed that a student really needs some space or a platform where they can discuss the issues related to violence, extremism, sectarianism, and other human rights violations. When I interacted with my students, and then gradually we noticed that we really need a kind of group, and we initiated some of my fellow professors and lecturers, we established a group of students. And soon we realized that it's a kind of all the Muslim students. So we met to Father Suhail. He was a Catholic priest in Pakistan, in my town. And then we included some Hindu representative, mm-hmm. and we established the organization. The purpose of this group was to create a kind of study circle group where students can discuss what they have in their mind related to so many issues,
mm-hmm.
particularly about violence, extremism, sectarianism. And then this gradually merged as an NGO. And we realized that besides these issues, the major issues in my, you know, country or in my society or in my community are the women issues. So we focused more on women side, and we have been struggling how we can bring women to the negotiation tables for peace building.
A very big need. Yes,
yeah.
I can well imagine. And so this relates to your being chosen in 2009 to come to the United States, to San Diego, as a woman peacemaker, which is when you and I first met those number of years ago. Has that residency at the Institute for Peace and Justice enabled you to gain another springboard in any way for your work when you're at home in Pakistan?
You know, the life of an activist is very congested life. You know, it's a life. You have pressure all the time from your staff, from community, from people, from family, so you never get time to reflect on. For me, the key thing which I have through this program, that I reflected on my work and I redesigned, reformulated my strategies. And, you know, that was a kind of strategic review for my future work.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And we specified for what we have to do for the next 3 years, for next 5 years, for next 10 years. One thing was we really evaluated our work. I did myself and then with my team.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing was the visibility.
Mm-hmm.
The program personally enhanced my visibility, but indirectly my organizational visibility. If I have been invited in different conferences, in different networks, you know, as a woman peacemaker, it means they are, you know, valuing or they are appreciating the work of TWO. So we improved, and particularly when you are in different networks, you learn, you exchange ideas, you learn more and more, mm-hmm. and improve your work.
Mm-hmm.
So of course it matters a lot to be a woman peacemaker. And finally you can get a lot of strength. You feel that you are a peacemaker's community, and it's a kind of support mechanism for you. So you could really play the, you know, your role with more confidence, with more energy, with more strength.
And I can see that you continue to do that. I think, sadly, we're drawing near the end of this conversation, and I don't want to end on this note, so I'm going to have a follow-up question to my next one. How much of a part is the Taliban playing in not permitting societies, especially yours, to flourish and grow? And do you ever fear for your life?
You know, the point is, like, every activist has fear for life, and even like anyone who's progressive. But somehow, currently, the military has been really struggling hard, and there is a successful operation, Zerbe has a program, operation, that was very successful. But still, you know, Taliban is not a group of people. It's not only a group of people. It's also mindset. And when we talk about technical challenges and adaptive challenges, of course, our military, our, you know, government has successfully met somehow that challenge, you know, technical challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And they have finished the pockets of Taliban, or, like, you know, they have really defeated them. But again, if they're a mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So that's is the biggest challenge. And that's not the role of government or the military. That's the duty and responsibility of each and every citizen of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
How you change that narrative, how you can create a kind of alternative narratives, a different mindset, a different ideology of love, tolerance, peace, and you know, where nobody will have a hatred feelings for each other.
Have you reached out to the members of the Taliban as a consequence of what you've just said?
You know, when you talk about the Taliban, Taliban mean all those people who have extreme thoughts. And when we work, of course, particularly when I have been engaged in interfaith work, we are bringing people together from a very hard kind of ideology,
mm-hmm.
extreme ideology, and mm-hmm. you are bringing them on the negotiation table. And initially it was very hard, particularly when you know, it's a different school of thought. And mm-hmm. when you are bringing two different school of thoughts together, it's not an easy thing. So that's why we don't say it interfaith dialogue, we say it dialogue of life.
Mm.
And when we bring people, we said, let us talk about our issues rather than our religion. Okay, mm-hmm. if we need a safe drinking water, everyone needs it.
Yes.
You know, either you are a Muslim, you are a Christian, you are an extremist, you are Catholic or Protestant, Shia or Sunni, everyone needs it.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, you know, if you are at the risk of climate change, floods, earthquakes, everyone is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
So let us talk, initiate a dialogue of life rather than interfaith dialogue, and try to discuss the scripture and who is superior and who is inferior and what are the commonalities and what are the differences. We have to talk about the issues and how we can resolve those issues. And this is much easier,
mm-hmm.
when you really address the needs of people.
Yes, rather than a group, you're addressing the very root, as you say, of their ideology.
Yeah, very cosmetics, because when you talk about the interfaith dialogue, then it means in every religion, you know, interfaith dialogue is, you can say, it's somehow dominated by men, religious leader, clergymen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So some bishops and some imams, some, you know, rabbis, they will sit together, because scripture is kind of, that will become more authentic when they are discussing. So where are the ordinary people? Where are the women?
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the dialogue of life, everyone would be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I love that title, Dialogue of Life.
Yeah.
I think every country in the world who has any sort of trouble, and there's many of them, would be very well served to select that and follow this model that you are creating.
And, you know, particularly when you bring the religious people, so it means you are giving a message, okay, peace building is their cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
those most, what you can say, privileged men, mm-hmm. you know, religion, mm-hmm. more powerful people. So mm-hmm. where is the, so it means they are our saviors.
Mm-hmm.
They will build peace and rest of the people, they are looking towards them. But peace is the responsibility of everyone. Women, men, belonging to, you know, elite class or poor class or working class or peasants. So when you engage them in dialogue of life, you can engage everybody. And mm-hmm. everyone knows about issues and everyone can contribute to the resolution of those issues.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to be engaged with you in this dialogue that we have shared. Perhaps one final question. What do you want those of us, especially I think in the United States, to think about when we think of Pakistan? What do you want us to visualize, to see, and to hope for you, for your country?
You know, I will say they would visualize like Pakistan is a country with so many potentials, with so many strengths, with so many good things, you know, and how we can share those things and how we can get information of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And Pakistan, they should have a kind of understanding that Pakistan is not the country the way it has been portrayed in the media. There is a different Pakistan and they must be curious about that Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. That is that is wonderful. I yeah. love that. Well, Rabina Feroz Bhatti, peacemaker, activist, and progressive woman, we are delighted to have shared this conversation with you and thank you for your time.
Thank you so very much. I really enjoyed, you know, this interview and conversation with you. Thank you so much.